Hey everyone, this is Adam Ellenboss from Nightlight Astrology, and today I am joined by my colleague Alex Amorosi to break down your horoscopes for the month of April. So we are going to be looking at two major transits this month. We're going to be looking at the Aries solar eclipse, which is happening on April 8th, and then we're going to be taking a look at the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction on April 20th, which is happening in Taurus. So we're going to be looking at those two whole sign houses for all 12 signs. You can listen to this, of course, for your sun or your rising sign. We recommend your rising sign, which will correspond with the whole sign house version of your birth chart. Before we get to that, I want to promote a couple of things that we have going on. And before I even do that, don't forget, as always, to like and subscribe. You guys just get more and more creative every week with the different ways in which to press the like button. And you can find a transcript of any of my daily talks on the website, which is nightlightastrology.com. Let's also take you over to nightlightastrology.com to remind you of some things that we have going on. We're getting close to enrollment season for spring programs. I'll be promoting that a little bit more shortly. And if you want to take a sneak preview, you can go into the courses, go to first year course. That starts in June. I'll be promoting that more actively starting next week. On the events page, if you go to live talks, you're going to find the Uranus in Love talk is the final of the Outer Planets in Love series that is happening on April 18th. So if you want to learn more about the significations of Uranus, whether it's in the natal chart or by transit, and how Uranus affects love and relationships, sign up for that webinar. You can get the replays to Neptune and Pluto in Love from the other 2 months. And then the other thing is, if you stick around at the end of today's talk, you can learn more about Ashley, my wife Ashley's upcoming herbal apprenticeship program, which starts on April 24th. So if you go over to skyhouseherbs.com and you click on the, click on the courses tab, go to the Herbal Foundations Apprenticeship. You can learn more about her program, which is starting at the end of April. And at the end of today's talk, after the content is over, if you'd like to learn more about it, what the program includes, how it all works, the pricing, any questions like that, which are all on the website, but you can stick around to hear more from Ashley. I did an interview with her that I've been posting at the end of the episodes recently so that you can learn more about that program that's coming up at the end of April. All right. On that note, I am really excited to have Alex back for April's horoscopes. Alex, welcome back.
We're doing it again.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Yeah, we've probably got... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say one of the biggest months of the year, I think, astrologically. It's just, there's a lot of punctuation marks in this month.
A solar eclipse in Aries and the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in Taurus. Major, every month when I'm doing the Kickstarter video, which you did with me this year, we look at the biggest transits for the year ahead. And without a doubt, April was like, okay, wow, we've got, this major stellium in Aries with a solar eclipse while Mercury's retrograde. And then shortly after, we have a Jupiter-Uranus conjunction within like 12 days. So that was my biggest month of the year. I know it was yours too. So I think most astrologers are looking at this as probably, I mean, there's maybe the Jupiter-Saturn squares in August and December, but they don't have as many things going on around them like we do here with an eclipse and Jupiter-Uranus together.
Agreed. This is a really like, there's so many tied together relationships this month. And so with that solar eclipse particularly, there's so much going on inside of it. Even just while it's happening, there's so much going on around it. Saturn and Mars are coming into a conjunction, Jupiter and Uranus into a conjunction, Jupiter is hosting Saturn and Mars. There's a whole, rabbit hole you can go down with all the interrelated facets of that eclipse too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I thought we would do is just show everybody the timeline and some of the other features around the eclipse and the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction, and then we'll break it down sign by sign. See what we've got going on. So this is the actual April 8th. So here you can see that we've got a North Node solar eclipse in Aries. Some of the things that stand out to me about this, in addition to the fact that Mars, the ruler, is conjoining Saturn in Pisces, is that this is a very cardinal moment. You know, in ancient Greek astrology, it was called tropical, which meant came from the word tropos, which meant like a turning point, a very powerful turning point. It's got that feeling of initiation and the punctuating, acting, starting qualities of Aries. Let's start something new. That's every solar eclipse. That's every new moon. But when it's in Aries like this, you've got a Mercury retrograde in Aries, Venus is in Aries, it's a north node eclipse, which also tends to augment our desires for something new. And then Mars and Saturn are coming together. You get the feeling that like effort, discipline, willpower, and the execution of a plan or a vision with a lot of strength behind it is going to be a part of this eclipse. But what are your impressions of it just looking at it?
Well, will you be okay if I say the word Chiron, Adam? Will you be okay?
I'll give you a pass.
I like to tease Abner because, you know, I use Chiron, he doesn't. But this eclipse is also directly to the minute conjunct Chiron. So I just wanted to bring up this. It is very powerfully involved in this eclipse. There's something about, you know, if I look at this from my sort of energy healing, energy work background, this would strike me as a moment where there's something significant that can be healed by really approaching something in a grown-up, disciplined manner, and that can move you forward in the inception of a very powerful new cycle, something totally brand new. And there's always the possibility, I think, with Aries, and particularly when the North Node is involved in Aries, to go too far, one step too far. And to really, I think this month, I think Saturn and Mars, you know, the more I look at that in a water sign, Saturn putting the brakes with Mars a little bit, there's a sense here where it's like, there may feel like you just want to launch the rocket ship, but you definitely need to double check your checklist. Like Saturn will provide a little bit of that break there where it's like, you know, the North Node sometimes can really feel, you can get hopped up on the North Node in a fire sign. And being pulled towards like, yes, this is the thing that is going to help and save me forevermore. But I think Saturn there does provide a good pause. Let's double check this. Because this is a huge lineup of points that are, thank you, Adam, you put Chiron in there. Awesome. A huge lineup of points in Mars's sign and the first sign of the zodiac, which is just known for its sort of rocket ship quality.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm not averse to Chiron. It's funny because I have Chiron.
I was just teasing you, by the way. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, look, I just, you know me, I'm someone who just doesn't like people cluttering up charts with too many symbols. But I should care more about Chiron because it's on my ascendant within a degree. So, you know, it's something that, it's like an archetype that I haven't taken the time that I probably should to get to know. But I know enough about Chiron. I've read several books about Chiron, read the mythology of Chiron, et cetera. So I am familiar. It does strike me as like when you have a solar eclipse on Chiron, one of the things I could imagine would be that we're incentivized somehow within ourselves to do something that constitutes an act of healing, an act of self-healing, an act of individuation for the sake of becoming wiser, more whole somehow. I mean, that seems fair for Chiron on the eclipse, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I read a few months ago, The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. It's a beautiful story, but tells us the story of the Iliad from Patroclus's perspective. And Chiron factors majorly into that, you know, the time Achilles spends learning from him. And I think it really brings up a wonderful archetype, almost like a Jupiter type archetype of like, if you are with Chiron in a way that you allow the wound to fuel a sense of wanting to heal and help, Chiron brings a sense of disseminating and teaching what we've learned. But the sort of the kind of like, you know, the older mentor Yoda type figure, like there's a sort of, I've been through a lot of hard stuff. I've seen it all. And this is what I've learned and what I had to learn in that process. And now I'm desiring to share it. Now I'm desiring to give it in some way.
Right.
And usually, you know, I just noted it is when the sun and the moon are actually, when the sun's actually eclipsed, they are to the minute 1924 Aries conjunct. So it's an interesting, it really is a punctuation mark I see on this eclipse as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the second thing that's happening that everyone is well aware of is we have on the April, whoops, went by hours. Let's scoot this back. Let's move this forward to April 20th. And I'll actually put Taurus on the ascendant there. Here's the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction. And this is happening just 12 days later. So they're pretty closely connected to one another. They have very different agendas on an archetypal level in a sense, but there's no reason they really can't be related to one another as well. If you think about the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in terms of Jupiter's emphasis on growth, expansion, fertility, and cohesion, like granting a more meaningful or wiser or richer or more expansive kind of life, then in Taurus, it's doing so for the sake of things like pleasure, embodiment, sensuality, a kind of stable, peaceful, enjoyable state of being. And then you add in Uranus, and Uranus wants to do so fast, rapidly, through eccentric thinking or progressive, innovative thinking that takes us outside of the familiar or outside of established habits, traditions, and patterns with a kind of sudden disruptive quality. The two of them together, it strikes me as providing us with the impetus to change the material circumstances around us in some striking ways, because we're seeking a more stable, a more peaceful, a more luxurious kind of earthly existence. Maybe for some people, that's really going to take them into bodily things that have been taboo or off limits. You know, a lot of us have been taught that the indulgences of Taurus are like just wicked, you know, like they're bad. But there is a shadow, of course, which is would be like the impatient kind of overly indulgent hedonism, like the Minotaur or something that could get pretty angsty. But I think for most of us, if you consider the preceding eclipse on Chiron, there's something here that's might be moving us toward wholeness and happiness in more embodied ways. And that, I think, that to me anyway, that's the promise that I see behind Jupiter-Uranus alongside of the Aries eclipse. But what about you when you add in Jupiter-Uranus? What are your thoughts, Alex?
That's beautifully said. I think, you know, it's interesting because I think Uranus is really good for Taurus, but difficult for Taurus, because Taurus usually generally like, you know, fixed earth. I like things to generally be status quo and the same and comfortable and that sort of idea. But I think that there's a sense with Jupiter here of, you know, sometimes what we think the revolutionary freedom, you know, freedom bringing act will be is not what it actually is. You know, sometimes I think, you know, we think like Uranus will be like, okay, I'm just going to break all the shackles and do something new and go crazy. And I can't even think of an example right now, but, you know, do that sort of thing. And sometimes it's like, maybe the radical idea is just like, you know, something that feels true and comfortable to you, something that feels right and good to you and embodied too. You know, this cycle began at the very, right about where Neptune is right now, at the end of Pisces in 2010, 2011. And there's something about tying together this, you know, the conclusion of a cycle that began with sort of a much more ethereal, watery, emotional quality, now beginning something that feels much more tangible, stable, grounded. And it might be a discernment here of what's practical, which might feel like the revolutionary act is, oh, for some signs and charts, it might feel like, you know, doing something that feels practical, stable, comfortable, or it might feel like, you know what, I need to jackhammer myself out of something that has felt really confining, something that has felt like it's gotten too stale or too stuck in the mud and somehow needs to be reworked in a way that launches us in a new direction.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea that Taurus can stagnate sometimes or get stuck, especially stuck in things that are like, well, it's working. If it's not broken, don't fix it. But Jupiter Uranus together in Taurus may be like, actually, there's two or three other options that could also work very well, be tangibly better, and work for a long time. So that, you know, in a couple of months, you might be saying, if it's not broken, don't fix it, with something that's significantly better than what you're dealing with right now.
Exactly.
So yeah, I love that. There's the other thing that comes to my mind for Jupiter Uranus is alongside of Pluto's entrance into Aquarius is the creation of space. You know, we talk so much about everything that's luxurious and enjoyable, and you almost get the picture in your head sometimes with Taurus of like a buffet that's just filled with tons of food. It's very opulent, it's beautifully arranged, and you get the feeling of fullness, like a cornucopia or something with Jupiter and Taurus. The other thing that's worth exploring is that Jupiter and Uranus and Taurus may also be about kind of creating spaciousness, because there's actually in some ways nothing more luxurious than spaciousness. And if you think about, like, I don't know, if you go you go on a date to a park and you spread out a blanket and it's the middle of a Saturday afternoon, there's nothing you have to do, dinner's 4 hours away, you got dinner on your mind for, you know, an evening plan, but you've got 4 hours in front of you, and there's a way that you feel that's just so open and stable and comfortable. And I can't help but wonder if some of this is, if it's less about what will you get, what will Jupiter Uranus lightning strike into your life that's suddenly like, oh, it's like Christmas, there's gifts everywhere, there's stuff. But what about the idea of also freeing us from entanglements? If you think about like a big pasture that the bull or the cows are in, it's just easy and it's open. So I also wonder about there being, especially with Aries too, who really likes freedom, coming off that Aries eclipse, that makes me wonder if it's like, are we actually seeking out more space, more freedom? That spaciousness is actually the real luxury.
I love that, because, you know, it takes into account too the natural quality of Taurus. That, you know, the Tauruses that I know, or people have strong Taurus in their chart, love being outside, love being in nature, love to garden, love to, you know. And I think that there's something about, you know, Uranus sometimes can bring about that feeling of where I have felt restrained, I can feel free in the sense that I know I don't have the opulent obligations that I used to have around me. You know, like sometimes when we have too much stuff, it's like that was a big tenet in the early Buddhism that I studied, you know, is that when we acquire so much, then it all has to be cared for and there's so much going on. And there's something about like maybe even a minimal quality to something like this, you know, where it's just like, I can do okay with less, or, you know, I could, you know, I'm just thinking about this is my 10th house, but, you know, I can work smarter, not harder.
Yeah.
I can, you know, decorate more minimally, not add on more stuff, where I can even clear things up. But I love that take on it. I hadn't considered that. That's a really cool take on that. I love it.
Well, I think that there's the one thing we can say about Jupiter and Uranus together is that there's a good chance it surprises us with things we aren't thinking of. And so I've just been trying to get into the mode of like, what am I not thinking of? You know what I mean? But anyway, shall we go into horoscopes?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it. We're going to start with Aries. I'll kick us off and then we'll alternate. So, and remember, we are looking at two major events. One, the solar eclipse in Aries on April 8th, followed by the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction on the 20th. So what I want to do is pair these two events together for you guys, or Alex and I both will, so that you can think about them as connected from house 1 to 2 for Aries. You're thinking about themes of individuation, individuality, independence, the executing of personal plans and agendas with a kind of a sudden spark or kick. There's a strong impetus to assert yourself in some way if you're an Aries. Develop yourself in some way. Take a step forward. Start something new. These are all first house significations. But it's also followed by the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in your second, which emphasizes a complete shift in resources or values, a shift in how you earn money or how you handle money or your investments or your expenditures, in the skills you're developing or utilizing, as well as the what you have around you that facilitates your deepest essence. Like what do you rely on, and how are the things that are at your disposal changing? And maybe some really nice new things are coming in that can support your personal growth and development, as well as anything involving the cultivation or development of your skills that lead to things like money or assets. stuff like that. So I feel like there's a strong connection here between the themes of individuation in the first house and resources, money, skills, and assets in the second that are connected here.
Yeah, agreed. You know, if I take my take on this from the second house, Jupiter and Uranus, right? There's this sense of like you're saying, like this wild rediscovery of worth, value, the things that you hold valuable, ways, you know, you could say it, a low hanging fruit here would be, you know, ways of making money you never considered before, and a lot of money generally with Jupiter. But it's what's interesting, and what's interesting to me here is that Jupiter Uranus is basically ruling the ruler of your eclipse, right? So you have Saturn and Mars in your 12th house. You know, as you go forward on this path that feels like I have to, you know, rocket ship, which is the word I'm really using for Aries today, to some new identity, some new individual sense of being individual, some new sense of freedom. My sense is that there will also be a need for reflection and contemplation about the more sensitive areas of your psyche that may not always be on the surface or may not be readily apparent to others, with Saturn and Mars and Pisces in your 12th house, that there's a sort of, there's a letting go or an ending of something in a more ethereal, emotional, sensitive space within you that is okay to see and doesn't make you any less Aries. It's just a part of what might be arising at this eclipse, and something about that connecting into, you know, this desire to really, really go forward and be who you are individually as yourself. Just not negating that part of you that might feel like there's a sensitive space that needs to be seen and honored and maybe healed in some way.
Yeah, it makes sense with Mars, Saturn in the 12th, the Chiron element in the first. That's a really nice take. Let's go ahead to Taurus. And now we're looking at the, and let me actually back this up so that I'm going to back this up to the eclipse date on April 8th.
Every time we turn the wheel as astrologers, I always want to sing the Jeopardy music.
Yeah, right. So now we're pairing the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in the first with the Aries eclipse in the 12th.
Wow. So this is really interesting. There, you know, if I were to use a little bit of a cliche here, I could see the impetus towards some kind of self-growth or self-work, right? There's a pull towards this eclipse in the 12th house that feels the desire to become more powerfully oneself by maybe going really deeply into the places within us that we're not used to seeing, or places within us that we're not comfortable necessarily revealing to the world. Like, you know, there's something about a Venus ruled ascendant, Taurus ascendant, that may not always feel comfortable with asserting oneself or individuating oneself or saying no, or say, you know, not looking for a consensus opinion, but just deciding to do something and going for it and excavating those spaces within the, you know, the subconscious that may need that kind of healthy expression, which leads to Jupiter Uranus in the first house, which just seems like a really powerful shift of identity, or maybe the sort of punctuation mark and the beginning of an identity that has been settling already. There's a sense of like, wow, I didn't know I could be this free. I didn't know I could allow myself this much leeway to do things that I really want to do and be exactly who I am. There's a lot of individuality coming up with these two, I think these two placements, you know, with Aries and then with the first house conjunction. There's something about like, I just get to be who the F I am and I don't care, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. As a, you know, card carrying member of the Taurus Rising Society, I concur. I feel like the Jupiter Uranus dynamic in the first house is, whether it's health, body, appearance, psychology, there's something about that conjunction that strikes me, and I've been feeling it myself, as the urge toward greater freedom. Mm-hmm. It could be creative freedom. It could be professional freedom, relational freedom. It could take place really in any area of your life because the epicenter is in you, the first house. But it is connected to, I think, the topic of power in the unconscious 12th house. How strong do I feel? Like you said, is it okay for me to be strong or assertive or Marsy? And for a Venus ruled sign, that's a maybe a more difficult spot to integrate the Aries 12th house. And it's a wounded spot, perhaps, with the Chiron element mm-hmm. involved too. So yeah, and I also think like one thing would be again with Mars and Saturn in the 11th, is it time to free ourselves from relationships with people or groups or friends or allies that are not allowing us to grow? You know, is there something about that 11th house Mars Saturn where we're just coming up against the limit of what limits of what's possible in certain with certain allies or colleagues or like groups of people, and we may have to consider that some kind of bold individuating action, even if it ruffles other people's feathers and it's not particularly Venusian, maybe that's needed in order for us to move on from like different 11th house relationships that aren't working.
Yeah, agreed. I love that.
All right, we'll keep going. And we'll put Gemini on the ascendant, starting to get some space back. Aries is crowding everything out.
I know.
Me! So yeah, Gemini places the Aries eclipse into the 11th with the Jupiter-Uranus dynamic in the 12th. There's two things that come to my mind for this one right away. One is, I mean, when it comes to collaborations and new collaborations, new friends, new groups, new allies that are appearing and maybe even acting as a kind of salve, like I didn't think I could have such healthy collaborations or friendships or people in my life, or I didn't think there was anyone out there who was going to take an interest in what I'm doing and show some belief in what I'm interested in. I mean, the 11th house was called the joy of Jupiter and a place of allies. And so, you know, I could see a very healing series of friendships or allies or groups or collaborations coming in for Geminis with the Chiron element involved, let's say, that, you know, make this a time of positive growth around community, around, you know, beneficial relationships, not necessarily romantic ones, right? But maybe more professional and social dynamics in your life. Now, the other thing with Mercury retrograde in that house and Chiron, and then the 12th house Jupiter Uranus also makes me think, similar to what we were saying about Taurus, is there some way in which you are ready to make a change of course, you know, really dramatically with respect to anything ranging from career with Mars Saturn in the 10th to groups of people, friends or allies? And the 12th house Jupiter Uranus to me suggests that, you know, don't be surprised if out from the unconscious comes a kind of explosion of sudden revolutionary impulses to just do something that feels better or do something that you want to do, that you don't have to feel limited, constrained, duty bound with friends or people or jobs. Or, and now on the other hand, with Jupiter Uranus in the 12th, you want to be careful that you sort of look before you leap, because the impetus to do something kind of rebellious in the name of something better and maybe that you feel will lead to some more luxurious, you know, state, then, you know, there could be a little bit of delusion that goes with it in the 12th house, right? So you want to be careful that you're not, for example, running into some kind of new situation impulsively that is not so grounded or stable. It's not what it appears to be. And that Chiron signature at the start of a solar eclipse could also be a seed planting around some healing work that you're going to do through the impulsive bonds that you're building with people right now, that in the future you're going to have to do some healing work, because the inclusion of Chiron to me would not mean that the healing is instant, but that a healing cycle may begin. So
exactly.
I think you can go either way. There's new healthy relationships, changes, revolutionary impulses around 11th and 10th house stuff. But then you do have to be careful that you're not being so impulsive and going into something blind because you're being impatient or butting your head against a wall and then doing something that's going to require a lot of work to extricate yourself from later.
Yeah, particularly with that butting your head against the wall, definitely in the career, because that Saturn Mars in the 10th house.
Yeah.
You could definitely see something where it's just like, I'm trying, Saturn, I think there will probably be something like, you got to know when it's enough. And I think the North Node in Aries, the same thing. It's like North Node is very close to this eclipse. It's very possible with this to like, I'm asserting and I'm going to assert myself. But sometimes, you know, I remember when I was learning to assert myself, because I wasn't very assertive before in my early life, sometimes it's very awkward when you're first doing that. And it's like, yeah, you blow up at somebody and all of a sudden, like, you're like, you know, cussing them out. And they're like, what? I just asked you if you wanted some espresso. Like, you know, you're right. Like, you're like, I want tea.
I'm learning to be assertive.
I'm speaking my truth. So, you know, that balances out too. But I think, you know, looking at Gemini rising, you know, living with the Gemini and who I love, it's okay to be stable too. I think this Jupiter Uranus might be, the revolution might be, it's also okay if there's certain aspects of you feel stable, centered, and status quo. I think it can feel for Gemini sometimes like the constant movement, you know, the mercurial nature of the sign, and Mercury's strongest sign, this nature to want to move and do and be different. This could be one of those instances where Jupiter and Uranus in the 12th house brings up an unconscious want or need to just have some comfort and stability in some space, yeah, of life. And yeah, that the pull might be away from that with all this Aries energy and Mars, you know, right at the top of your chart and so on and so forth. But if, you know, if you discover there's a place within you that's like, you know, in some way, shape, or form, I do want to have some sense of predictability and stability, and just listen to that voice, see, yep, where it takes you, because it's an interesting one here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the other thing that comes to my mind with Geminis is that your ascendant ruler Mercury is retrograde in the 11th. So yeah, how much of this could also be about revisiting things from the past, or revising or revisiting, mm-hmm, relationships, mm-hmm, or even your career aspirations and things like that. There's some kind of revisionary process for you in all of this. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to Cancer on the ascendant. Alex, you got this one with the 10th house Aries eclipse and the 11th house Jupiter Uranus conjunction.
Oh, just, you know, watch your mouth at work. Don't run your mouth at work. Yeah, Mercury retrograde. This is one where it's like, if you've been thinking for a while, there's something that needs to change. You know, I with my job situation, there, the impetus to change will feel probably very strong around this eclipse. This is a really strong gravity while pulling in that direction. And I think, like, you know, pairing that together with Jupiter and Uranus, there's a sense where if you're going in a new direction in your job or your career, even just the way you're sort of, you know, your legacy or how you're seen in the world, there's a potential here to really mix up the people who support you in a really beneficial way. Like there could be, you know, this would be, if I was doing a reading and I saw this, I would say, like, you know, be open to what comes to you through your LinkedIn, be open to what comes through to you through a friend of a friend at another company who happens to know a position is open. And then that, like, listen to those sort of things. Like, I never thought I would have wanted to do that, or that was the job I wanted to do, or that was the way that I wanted to express myself in my career. But now as Jupiter and Uranus come together, it's sort of, Uranus usually opens up something you never thought of before. And then you could be like, oh, that's cool. Or it might bring up something where it's like, it sounds really good on the surface and it sounds really freeing on the surface, but there may be more contention with it down the road than you may have thought with all of this Mars energy in the air too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well put. I think, you know, I was thinking Ashley's a Cancer rising, and she's returning to work right now after, you know, choosing to be kind of full-time mom mode for a couple of years. Yeah. And now that the kids are both in school and she's stepping back into her work, it aligns with these North Node eclipses. I can't help but think that whether someone's well into their career and hasn't left or not, that there's a new cycle of activity beginning for Cancers in their career house. How you engage with the world outside your home if you're retired, I always just mention that because that could be the case as well. But a new cycle offers new opportunities for healing and for an encounter with Chiron. Like, what kinds of wounds do you carry with respect to your public reputation? Our egos are intimately wrapped up for most of us with how the world sees us and the roles we play with vocation or reputation. So there might be the beginning of new activity in the career house and new inner work with respect to our egos and the roles we play in and through vocation. And then I also think about new opportunities in career that correspond with really some exciting and maybe unexpected opportunities with respect to things like community, groups and allies and unexpected resources. This has the feeling of like a door opening and new resources being available to us with respect to our dreams and goals in the public arena anyway. So for most people, that's going to be vocation. But a nice, really a nice combination. Now, the Mercury retrograde could have us needing to revise something or rework something. In the career house, I found that sometimes that creates a little bit more work, you know, like a little extra. It always, you know, it's like right in the middle of a busy season where lots of things are taking off, where suddenly you realize that something on your website isn't working, or, you know, like the Mercury retrograde could imply that, you know, you're going to have to rework some things this spring around the eclipse. But the new opportunities are really pouring in, which I think will outweigh any kind of busy work.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
All right. Let's move along to Leo. So for Leo, we have the solar eclipse with Chiron in the 9th, and we have Jupiter and Uranus together in the 10th. So with respect to these two placements, for Leos, generally speaking, I feel like there's a couple of things that stand out to me with the eclipse in the 9th. And now I'm sort of adding in Chiron. One would be that if you are ready for some change in perspective, your belief systems, your philosophies, how you navigate the world based on your higher principles, this eclipse will bring those changes. It'll start them. It'll start you down a path that says, okay, it is time to deeply reconsider the way that I see the world and the beliefs and values that help me navigate my ship. The 9th house, 1st house, and 5th house were all connected to the idea of Dharma in Indian astrology. And the 9th house would be like, you know, to whatever extent we live a life with some spiritual or religious principles, all the more likely we are to navigate our ship successfully through all of life's different seasons. Right now, there's something new cooking in that house, right? It's like for Leo's a new way of looking at the world that will help you navigate your ship better. That's the really great possibility. And maybe there's healing that has to happen. Healing the mind, healing our faith. Our faith can get damaged. Our faith can get shaken, whether that's faith in God or faith in anything, any kind of value system. So I like this as a revision, a revising, a healing, a developing, a deepening of our faith, beliefs, and outlook on life. But it could also initiate new things around teaching and teachers, you know, gurus, spiritual practices, travel abroad, all of which could be packed with a lot of value that actually somehow bootstraps, like a bootstrapping of, you know, our evolution. Like you take a trip, you take a program, whatever, something happens in the 9th house. And with that Aries energy, it is like, it's going to launch you forward in ways that, you know, for a lot of people, for example, and you're very familiar with this, people go to yoga teacher training. So they go to a yoga retreat. And that yoga retreat is its own thing. It's a 9th house thing. They come back and their whole life changes because of it. And that's the kind of energy that I see for Leos, along with Jupiter Uranus in the 10th, which is really creating similar similar breakthroughs around vocation, career, and where you see your life going with respect to calling and professional life. So I like that those two are pretty closely linked for Leos right now.
Yeah, you know, thank you again, once again, for describing my life, Adam. I appreciate it. That's very much where I'm at myself right now as a Leo rising. And I think that, you know, this strikes me too as, you know, if you've been through a long cycle of learning different types of systems of belief, ordering the world, making sense of the world, maybe even healing and restoring your faith. One of the things I found so interesting about the way Chiron is depicted in that book, I was in the Song of Achilles, he really has that sense of the stable, calm mentor. And there might be some mentoring roles that you're coming into in terms of teaching people about what you've learned. You know, I could see like a Ypres Love, like you write a book about something you have been going through in terms of reestablishing the way you see the world and your order of the world and your sense of faith. And you teach others from that, you know, that could really tie into career. Like, you know, maybe I never saw myself as someone who does the lecture circuit or the speaking circuit or the author circuit, whatever, but it's starting to happen, or the gravity is starting to pull me in that direction. And it might be, you know, too, just something I've also noticed with Saturn and Mars in the eighth house, there might be some endings that are happening on a much deeper energetic level with some old bonds that you've had that may have felt restraining in some way, or maybe where it's just like, you know, me and this person are going in another direction, or, you know, this deep karmic tie that once served me maybe doesn't serve me as much anymore. So there might be a little bit of, letting go required too, graceful letting go.
Right. Yeah. I could see this also as like a, almost like the image of settling something, with someone else, like a, the image of like an out of court settlement comes to my mind, but that's really extreme. But what I really mean is just, that there's maybe some way in which you can release old debts, or there's a need to evolve, and that requires facing certain kinds of bonds or relationships and really evaluating them, because sometimes it's hard for us to move forward until we've let go of things that are definitely going to become a problem for us if we try to move forward.
Amen. And thank you once again for speaking to my life.
Let's go on to Virgo, which places the Aries stellium in the eighth and Jupiter Uranus in the ninth.
So this is, this is interesting with the eighth house here. And I've been really, considering your blood bank analogy for this, for the eighth house, Adam, a lot of, right? Thinking a lot about it. It's a really great analogy for it. You know, this may be a place where if I was looking at another sign, I might say something different, but for Virgos, the tendency is usually towards giving and service and, whatever you need. And I want to make sure everything's okay. And are you satisfied and happy and all those sorts of ideas. And in Aries, in solar eclipse in the eighth house may indicate a place where you're like doing something kind of uncomfortable, which is, I don't need to be giving and of service all the time. And I may have overdone that. And now I need to move toward, I may have actually, incurred some more longer term wounds that I'm moving towards a space in the eighth house of like, now it's time for me to receive. Which can be one of the most challenging things, I think, for Virgos and for Libras, to really let yourself recognize it doesn't always have to be you that's giving. It doesn't always have to be you that's being perfect and holding it all together and trying to walk the tightrope so that everybody, feels that you're doing things like beyond reproach. Sometimes you can just say, in a healthy way, by the way, F it, I'm going off to do this. Yeah. I'm going to receive. I'm going to take for myself. And I think that Jupiter Uranus in the ninth house, in Taurus particularly, maybe reevaluating, one sense of ordering the world. It's okay to order the world around comfort and your comfort sometimes, your resources, your embodied needs are also important. I think it's a really powerful, this could be a very transformational sequence for Virgos this month.
Yeah, I mean, especially when we consider again the Mars-Saturn conjunction in the seventh that's ruling the eclipse. It really makes me feel like if you are, let's just say, if you're dealing with people who are domineering and not fair, and you're dealing with people who are not making an effort at reciprocation, that this is a place to separate yourself, to just claim independence. On the other hand, I could see Mars Saturn coming together with the Aries eighth house as the incentive to join yourself with other people in focused, disciplined efforts towards something that you really care about, that you're willing to sacrifice on behalf of, and that there's a higher belief that's coming in and creating some kind of very deep bonding and cooperating with other people, something you can't do by yourself. But you could go in either direction because the symbols really speak to the theme of either not going it alone and joining for the sake of something more, or separating because there's some kind of inequality and seeking out greater freedom and like independence from unhealthy bondage.
Yeah, I like that. I like the contrast of the two. Absolutely.
Yeah, because it'll hit differently for different people, yeah. The same exact planets, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go on to, did you want to say anything else about that?
No. That was, I really enjoyed that point. Yeah.
Let's go on to Libra, where we have the Aries eclipse in the 7th and Jupiter Uranus in the 8th. Now, I think you could actually make some of the same exact, you could make some of the same descriptions for Libras, because you've got the Aries stellium in the 7th, which can initiate new cycles in love and relationships that are very powerful and that provide you with new, a newfound sense of, let me just put it this way. Like, sometimes there are relationships that come into our lives, and even though we are bonding and joining ourselves with someone else, the relationship grants us more freedom. The very mundane example being that you may not have to carry such a load financially. You share rent, you know, like I remember when my wife and I got together and I was like, holy crap, you can do this with another person. This is great. You know, like I can split the grocery bill, like, you know, stuff like that. And, yeah. And so just, but like, let's expand it beyond the mundane and the financial piece. There are ways in which people enter our lives and the value that they bring grants us more freedom and more opportunity and more possibility for expansion. That's the kind of thing that I'm seeing here on the most positive note that I can think of with the Aries stellium. There's some healing maybe too with Chiron wrapped up in it. And then Jupiter Uranus in the 8th providing this kind of unexpected opening through the resources, assets, and through what others bless us with in their presence or what they have, what they're in touch with. So I like that. I like this as a strong moment for partnering. Now flip it around, because I think you have to look at the shadow too. The other aspect here might be about, you know, like any kinds of eighth house, like any kind of devil's bargain where it's like, oh, look at how strong that person is. Look at what they have. Look at their assets. Look at what they could give me. And there's a kind of selfishness where we're not actually evaluating whether or not this person is a good match. We're seeing them in terms of what they have or what they're in possession of that we could come into possession of by proxy. That's a huge it's a huge part of how we evaluate relationships. It's actually healthy. We have to consider, like, what does this person have that they're bringing on into my rowboat with me? Because we're trying to get to the far shore, you know? But like, on the other hand, the companionship piece and the mingling of souls is primary. You can't put the cart before the horse. So I would look at Libras who sometimes struggle with this kind of evaluation, the objective picture of what looks good, what on paper fits, versus a deeper exploration of what is or isn't aligned with my heart. And I think that's probably maybe that's something that's wrapped up in all this too.
Oh, I love that. And I really identify with a lot of that from a Libra moon perspective, you know, is that wherever I got into trouble in relationships in my early life was always because they were good on paper. They looked like they would work. It's like, and we bring these resources, we have this, but it's just like, but you're not aligned. You're not compatible. There's something that just doesn't work on a level where you feel stable, safe, and secure emotionally and spiritually and on so many ways that you really need to in a relationship. And I was reflecting as you were talking about that, Adam, like with the healing element involved in this type of eclipse, there's some sort of like older wound or some older pattern that is either seeking resolution or coming to the surface. That one of the ways I think that on the flip side, you were saying, we feel we can do a lot more sometimes when someone is in our corner that we feel stable, safe, and secure with. We feel like we can launch more. We feel like we can open more. If you feel sort of like there's a safe, soft place to come back to at the end of the day to talk this over with, like you said, and then practical level, there are resources that you have that are capable of doing that with. I think that distinction between like seeing on the surface what might look good and then seeing what is beneficial, but also connected to you on a heart level is really important here. And there may be some amount of sacrifice necessary just because that eclipse is ruled from your sixth house. There's like, you know, some old cycle is like, you know, it might feel hard to let go of this pattern, but if I do, there's a lot more connection and resource and stability that's on the horizon for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. So I think we've handled Libra well enough. Let's move on to Scorpio for you, Alex. This places our Aries eclipse in the sixth and the Jupiter Uranus conjunction into the seventh.
Okay. So I think that this is really interesting. This eclipse to me would be a new cycle of persevering through something that might on the surface feel like a challenge, or something that may feel like it needs to be taken back in some way. Like it feels like power was taken away in some way, or some part of yourself or your soul was taken in some way. And there's an impetus with this to heal by going on the quest to reclaim that. However that looks, and that can look in many different ways. But I would think with Jupiter and Uranus coming together in the seventh house, that there is some kind of relational aspect to this, the way you relate to other people, your primary relationships, marriage, those, you know, common topics for the seventh house, that there's a new way, maybe radically new way of seeing relationship that sort of facilitates this process of, you know, going on a sacred quest. And, you know, so you think of like the idea of, you know, whether it's literal or metaphoric, like the shamanic soul retrieval, where you go back and you say like, you know, something was taken from me. I was deprived of something, and I'm going to get that back, or I'm going to find it in the present moment and have a sense of feeling whole and complete again in some way that I may not have for a while. There's like something that's being drawn back into the present moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. So I do too wonder about like, what's the thorn in your side? This for Scorpios, the Aries Chiron, the solar eclipse conjoined Chiron in the sixth, the place that was described by ancient astrologers as those things that we struggle with or that we have to sacrifice for. And also the labor that we do. And this sense of what frustrates us, but also by means of which we develop character and perseverance. It's a really rich house. But with Chiron there, I just wonder, what have we had enough with? Like if you're a Scorpio, like where you might be at a breaking point where you're like, you know what? I am ready to overcome something that has been an issue for a while, and it's going to take courage and perseverance. I happen to know a Scorpio rising who is at last having a surgery that they didn't want to have, but they're so sick of dealing with something that they're just like, I'm finally going to do this thing that I know is going to set me back a while. And I'm going to have to not be, you know, work and child rearing and all the stuff that's going to be really hard to do, but I'm so sick of doing this. And sometimes, you know, the image that kind of comes to my mind with Chiron there, and I think it's probably because of the glyph that I thought of this. Sometimes it takes a thorn to dig a thorn out. There's a kind of effort and willpower and sacrifice. And I see Mars and Saturn in the fifth, and they seem to suggest, look, for the sake of your joy, for the sake of your happiness, make this effort. You know, it in the short term may suck. In the long term, it'll set you free. You'll feel so much better. You'll overcome. You'll prove to yourself that you're capable, and it will be okay. And it actually, in a weird way, rather than thinking about Jupiter and Uranus in this context as the seventh house of relationships, I think about it in the way that ancient astrologers talked about it, as the setting place, the place of resolution, which is the when the sun sets, it's like, ah, work day is over, close the shop, let's go to the marketplace or the village and, like, you know, dance, or what do we do in the nocturnal space, right? We set the work down for the day. It's done. It's complete. And they talked about the seventh house in that respect. I can't help but wonder for Scorpios, if you're ready for something a little bit better, a little bit more peaceful, but it might require digging a thorn out with a thorn. But the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction coming up right after it suggests, look, if you do this, a cycle of struggle is going to be complete.
Agreed. I love that. You know, as someone who went through a series of sixth house transits, not the least of which was Pluto over the last 15 years, that is exactly what the sixth house feels like. And, you know, what I think is great, you're as a Mars ruled ascendant, and this is a Mars ruled sign where this is happening, is it gives you the determination necessary. The sixth house, like I felt it happen when I had a series of transits through the sixth house. It's like, you got to pull up from deeper within you. Like, this is what I want. If this is what's required, so be it.
Yep. Yep.
But determined to get there. Yeah.
Yep. Well, let's move to Sagittarius, which takes us into the fifth house with the Aries eclipse, and the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction goes into the sixth. One of the things that I love about the fifth house, as I've been getting to know it more and more, is that I've been spending a lot of time looking at the triads through the Indian tradition, ancient Indian tradition, which shares so much with the ancient Hellenistic tradition. And you guys have heard me before talk about the fifth house as a place that was described as the joy derived from one's dharma or connected to one's dharma. It sort of is like, there's a way in which the Indian philosophy of astrology is saying, look, if you are in touch with your inner essence, there should be, like, not constant unending happiness, but there should be happiness and a sense of fulfillment and ease and joy that is rhythmic, that's like, that's there, that is flowing. And like, I don't think anyone would say that that's in the material world, that that's something that's going to happen 24/7. But I think that when you have this kind of Aries eclipse with the Chiron in the fifth house, for Sagittarius right now, the question is, what is going to make you feel freer and happier? And it might be that simple. Now, that could expand into, for some people, that might be like a choice about whether or not to have children. For some people, it might be about creative projects. For people who are retired, it might be about, like, are you doing anything that actually makes you happy in retirement? Are you taking some risks? Are you doing new things? You promised yourself you'd always do these things when you retired, but you're not doing them. Whatever. The point is that as a matter of personal healing, the question of happiness and unprohibited joy and freedom is paramount right now. It's just really important. Now, Jupiter Uranus in the sixth to me suggests that if you're going to get there, you have to make there's a breakthrough required in your thinking. You have to stop pushing a boulder up the hill and letting it roll back down. You got to think about what you're struggling with and why you keep struggling with the same things. Now, when I pair that with, because Jupiter Uranus in the sixth can constitute a breakthrough with respect to the things that we're struggling with. And if you pair that with the emphasis on greater freedom and happiness in the fifth house, you get kind of a story there. But then I also look at Saturn and Mars in the fourth, and I think to myself, okay, this house was called Moksha by Indian astrologers, which could mean enlightenment from the body and the material realm and rebirth. But it also just means freedom from stress and struggle that's more normal for the workaday world. When you come home at night, it's kind of similar to the seventh house. There's just a release or a liberation from worldly concerns. Ah, now it's time to make some popcorn and watch a movie and, you know, hang out or whatever. So that kind of Mars Saturn in the fourth is maybe pointing towards an inability that you have because of restlessness or being overly busy or, you know, punishing yourself with the same old struggles, that there's some inability to release, to just let go. And so I wonder if these pairings sound strange, because Sagittarians are usually very free spirited, right? But the thing is that Sagittarius was also a sign that was associated with constant movement, warfare, competition. Sometimes Sagittarius are busy and active, but not necessarily happy.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's like, there's angst sometimes with all of that. The centaurs are interesting because they're very wise creatures, but a lot of them are also very like angry and belligerent and kind of sometimes like drunken. That doesn't mean that you have to think about those things literally, but I would look at these things and say, yeah, but is it easy? Are you having fun? Is the ease and joy and activity in your life freeing? Is it truly uplifting?
Yeah. I mean, that's beautifully said. I think, you know, in Astrology of Fate, Liz Green talks a lot about Sagittarius in the centaur archetype and relates it somewhat to Chiron and sacrifice. You know, Sagittarius is sometimes, I might be speaking a little from projection here from being a Sagittarius. There is a sacrificial quality you don't think a lot about with Sagittarius. Like, I'll just get it done. No big deal. Like the hope on the horizon. Like, it's fine. It's okay. It's whatever. And eventually it'll start to wear you out. And, you know, you start to realize like, oh, I've kind of been overdoing it here and feeling like I had to or obligated to, sometimes guilty about, you know, not doing it. And I'm wondering if there's a need to assert on behalf of your creative pleasure here. With this eclipse, there's just like a, you know, in order to have my movie and popcorn and snuggle at the end of the night, I have to stand up and say something here, which might not be easy to do or might actually be healing for a longstanding wound around not feeling like one can assert on behalf of one's own pleasure and happiness. And I think that, you know, I think that there are a lot of great allies for this. I'm not sure it'll be entirely comfortable, but I also see Jupiter and Uranus in the sixth too. I could just see that is like I just threw the ring in the volcano, man. I'm good. You know, I can kick back now. And there might actually be something that happens in terms of a breakthrough in some long-standing kind of logjam that's been going on that feels like, oh, okay, now you know what? The next thing is I deserve to be happy. I deserve to feel joy. I deserve to feel connected to myself. I deserve to go home at the end of the night and close my computer at a reasonable hour. That sort of feeling.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Move on to Capricorn next. And we've got the Aries eclipse in the fourth house with Jupiter Uranus conjoining in the fifth. Mm.
It's almost similar in a way. I'm seeing, you know, with Sagittarius, it was a couple different, you know, shifts here. But, you know, I look at this and I reflect a lot on, again, that idea of, you know, the Capricorn cross to bear, the thing I have to carry, you know, and not let taint me. And I think that there might be something in this eclipse about looking back into ancestral lineage wounds, things that have come down over the centuries, maybe that have just kind of wound their way through your family line, and an impetus to take some action on them once and for all. Right. Sometimes, you know, and I've developed a lot of respect for this lately and some of the classes I'm taking this year on trauma-informed healing. There's someone who comes along who in a family line that just says, enough, it ends here. Whatever this is, it ends here. You know, to use the ring again, I'm going to be the one who throws the ring in the volcano. And that's not always easy. But on the other side of that, you know, this Jupiter Uranus in the fifth house might be saying, like, in the name of radically altering your relationship to the desire to have things that are enjoyable or feel centered in a space of joy within yourself, not always happy, but a more stable, abiding sense of joy, there might just be one or two things that you do some intensive work around that finally says, enough, it ends here with me, whether it feels right or not, you know, or fair or not. Sometimes that just falls in our laps, you know?
Yep. Yeah, for sure. As you were speaking, I just realized that I wasn't set up with the correct microphone. So my audio quality is probably not very good. So just apologies to everybody listening. My mic was not, I didn't have the right mic selected. On dovetailing with what you just said though, and getting back to this Capricorn horoscope, any new cycle that's getting started around ancestry and family karma, living environment, home, property, land, makes a ton of sense for this Aries eclipse. I also think we're breaking ancestral karma with respect to, for parents out there, with Jupiter Uranus in the fifth house of children, and then all of this Aries energy in the fourth. I really appreciate what you were just saying, Alex, because this, for a lot of parents, this who are Capricorn risings, this is going to be about creating a totally different scenario for your kids. There's like breaking of family curses comes to mind. Mm-hmm. The other thing though would be just any way in which you can go in a new direction with respect to home and family that has this dovetailing with greater happiness or creative fulfillment. Just those two things together in the fourth and the fifth
come to my mind. And then also, how do you set up the environment around you to be conducive to greater happiness and creative fulfillment and to support a new cycle around your roots, your home and your family, because of Mars Saturn in the third, their presence makes me think that you may have to do some critical judging or evaluating of what's around you that will or will not support the kind of foundational change that you're trying to make.
Yeah, you may need to, if you can, you know, a little nook in your house or a room in your house that's just yours. Like, you can't have the interruptions around there. You need just like a space. I always say that with them teaching people meditation. Even if you just have one space where you sit and meditate every day, that becomes your routine and the energy is imbued there where it makes it more conducive to the work.
Yeah, I like that. Aquarius rising. I'll take this one. And we look at the eclipse in the third with Jupiter Uranus in the fourth. This is interesting because this house associated with the angular seventh and the 11th by trines. I've been looking at those in those triads, like I said, in Indian astrology. It's a house that's related to pleasure and to pleasure through other people. But in the third house, the best way that I've found of thinking about what that means more tangibly is about people and culture. Because if you think about the culture of a fish tank, the fish, which is, let's say in this case, the birth chart owner, may have a little rock that they live under that they like to hide under. The rest of the aquarium, including the other fish, including the algae that's growing, is the culture that they live in. It's the ecosystem that they're familiar with. And so a lot of our happiness is actually dependent upon how well we are matched with an environment that we're living in. It's a psychic environment. It's emotional. It might be socioeconomic or political. I mean, it's so many different things. And a lot of what culture is with respect to astrology's third house is subtle. It's not necessarily gross. It could be your next door neighbor. In the ancient world, it would be like your kin and your siblings, people who live in and around where your parents raised you. But in nowadays, culture is a really intangible thing because we're all online. We all have little avatars we're running around with, and we're multidimensional when it comes to cultural overlaps that we have, you know. But when I think of Aquarians right now, I think, oh, Aquarius is ready to take some big risks or some strong, bold, new decisions with respect to what the culture of your life looks like. Cultural innovation comes to mind for Aquarians right now, which has to do with people, places, and subtle things around you that you align with or not. It could be that culture is shifting or changing as you're also looking at your resources and what you are limited by, or how you're trying to develop skills, abilities, and resources to overcome various limitations, kind of the Mars Saturn in the second. This is also connected intimately with Jupiter Uranus trying to create a breakthrough in the fourth house, which is the place of foundations. I look at all of this for Aquarius rising, and I think to myself, I would not be surprised if you have a good handful of Aquarians, for example, who are trying to move, reallocate resources, get into a different neighborhood that reflects different, maybe like, you know, you're moving from a city out to the country because you want a little bit more natural environment. Whatever the case may be, it's like, it feels like an evaluation of resources, assets, and values with a desire to shift something around in the environment so that there's more happiness and connection. And it's also going to link back to things like home, family, and living environment.
Yeah, I love that. I think there's, you know, I was reflecting as you were talking about, one of my history professors in college would often talk about climate, you know, different countries and civilizations and the climate that's involved in that, and how that climate affects the events that go on within historically. Like, there's just sort of a space we exist within that we even just say, well, that's just the way things are, but we don't realize that it's sort of a generated climate and culture and those sorts of ideas that we have. And I'm wondering about the, maybe even with Aries too, like the realization, like I've been caught in a culture I didn't realize I was, or I've been in an environment, like you were saying, that like doesn't support me on all levels, or is not allowing me to see the worth and value that I have to offer to the world. and I need to break from it, or I need to move from it, or I need to shift from it in some way. And I think that when you bring the formidable intellectual power to connect that Aquarians have, but also their general sense of deeply held values, deeply ingrained held values, it might be a time where it's just like, you know, I didn't realize that maybe my values don't align in some way, and I have to make a bold new change in what surrounds me and where I am in order to feel like I'm in line with them again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last but not least, we have Pisces with the Aries eclipse in the second and the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in the third.
So this is interesting. I think that, you know, for a Pisces, it's so important, or one of the skills that sometimes I think we have to learn skills that are not natural to us, but are necessary in some way to move us forward or help us feel empowered. I think there's something here about really boldly taking action on behalf of your own value. And it's very easy, I think, especially for mutable signs and a mutable water sign like Pisces, you know, there's an adaptability to that. Like, well, it's cool here. It's cool. It's cool. It's cool. And now I think there's something where it's like, but have I said it's cool? It's okay. That's all right. Too much. I think, you know, I've often found over the years that, you know, self-betrayal is not often one big act. Sometimes it is, but it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. It's death by a thousand, you know, okay. Or, oh, maybe here. And this eclipse really might say, like, you know, I have to assert on behalf of my value. I have to charge what I'm worth. I have to, whether it's literally or metaphorically, I want to take a stand here on behalf of what really lifts, supports me. And it's okay to have those things that support me and take a very definitive stand on that. Again, it may not feel entirely comfortable for a mutable sign like Pisces, but it could feel really empowering, and it could feel like it shores you up in a lot of ways and maybe leads to some considerations you have never crossed your mind before about what's surrounding you, who's around you, the people that surround you, who are the, you know, I think about oftentimes, you know, the person who's whispering in the emperor's ear, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. What are the people who are surrounding you, and what's their influence on you? And I think of, there was something I was listening to on some podcast the other day that said, you know, what surrounds us and who surrounds us is one of the biggest indicators of where we'll wind up and what we'll do.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something with Jupiter Uranus here of like some real revelations about what that is and maybe some really beneficial changes that could come from it.
Right. Yeah. It also makes me think, what is your limit? You were kind of getting at this, but like, where is your hard limit? And that could be with respect to really anything, time, energy, money, resources, relationships, jobs. Like, where is your, I can't do anymore. I've given all that I can. I've got to stop here. And then also I see that as a real theme with Mars, Saturn governing the first house with such an emphasis with the eclipse in the second. You're thinking about your time, your money, your energy, or your resources, and what you feel like you have and what you feel like you don't have within you. Then I also think about, saying, you know what, I'm going to put my nose to the grindstone, and I am going to work really hard on behalf of something new that I want to cultivate, that I want to bring forth from myself. And the Mars Saturn feels like it's this melding of, you know, like almost like the, what is it? Superman, the Man of Steel. Is that the,
I think so. I think so. Yeah.
But it kind of feels like that. Mars Saturn coming together is like an iron, emotionally palpable, like will to do something. Yeah. And it's on behalf of some new asset or resource that you want, and it's going to make your life better. And there's just kind of belief that I can do this. Jupiter Uranus in the third is also suggesting that maybe this is connected to something that you really feel needs to change in the world around you. That fish tank analogy again, where Jupiter Uranus says, the culture's got to change, the culture of my life, the environment of my life, mentally, emotionally, physically, environmentally, I'm ready for something different here, and I'm going to cultivate a new kind of resource. I'm going to bring forth a new kind of version of myself, better equipped, et cetera, et cetera. So it feels like a lot of like self-driven developmental qualities for Pisces. I'm cultivating something. I'm building something. I'm developing something. I need more from myself. I'm going to push myself, or I'm going to develop something new because I've realized that I can't give any more to something else.
Yeah.
Kind of reaching a limit.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Wow.
We did it.
We did it. April. We
did it again. Yeah. Okay. So I want to make sure that people know where they can find Alex. If you enjoyed Alex's work, and I know you guys do every month, please check out his website, which is alexamorosi.com. You can book sessions with him there. You can learn more about his work, get on his newsletter list. Find him on Instagram at alexamorosihealing. Alex has been kind enough to host a few talks while I'm on spring break, so you guys have seen him recently as well, and we just really appreciate everything that you do. Alex, anything you want to tell people about, or is this good?
No, that's great. Thanks again for having me. I always enjoy being here. It's great to riff on all the stuff going on. Yeah.
Absolutely, for sure. And remember, I said at the beginning, stick around after Alex and I sign off. You can check out that interview I did with Ashley about her upcoming herbal apprenticeship program. And if you have any questions about that afterward, by the way, after you listen to that video, you can email us info@nightlightastrology.com and I can connect you with Ashley or give you more info. We work, she's literally right outside that door. So you can contact either of us. All right. That's it for now. Take it easy, everyone. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for sticking around. I'm really happy to be joined by my wife, Ashley, who is an herbalist. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
And yeah, I'm really excited to be helping Ashley promote her upcoming program, which is something that you actually began teaching many years ago, this herbal apprenticeship program. I think it was, 2011 or 12 that it got started, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's been over 10 years I've been offering this course, and yeah, it's my favorite thing to teach.
Yeah. And just to be clear, because some people on my channel, most people know you because you pop on here or there, we talk about herbs and astrology. There's an attraction in our marriage and an attraction in the subject matter that is old. Like we've been together for, 14 years in our relationship going on. And we've always had a fascination with each other's areas of expertise, and we've done lots of things to marry them together over the years, in addition to literally getting married. And and actually, herbalists and astrologers have married the subjects of herbs and planets together for thousands of years as well. Now, your program is focused on, herbalism. It's not an astrology course, but there is certainly a lot of overlap in terms of the energetics and the spiritual approach to herbalism that you take. And so I was hoping that we could start off just by telling people a little bit about the program. You're coming to this after taking a little bit of time on maternity leave. Our kids were not yet in school. Now they are. You're coming back to work. This is really exciting. The new program launches at the end of April. I'm going to put it up on the screen so people can see it. You can find it at skyhouseherbs.com. Enrollment is open now. The course begins. You go under Courses, Herbal Foundations Apprenticeship at the end of April. Tell us about it.
Well, this course, I guess my goal in redesigning the apprenticeship course that I've been teaching for 10 years is to make it even more personal and to allow people to study the material, digest it at their own pace. So what it's going to be is a combination of kind of three main parts. The first one is the recorded material. So there's going to be modules that will be released and people can listen to them as they, as they have time. The second part are live classes where we will meet live on Zoom and talk about the module, I'll answer questions, I'll give even more information about it. And then the third part is the sacred plant pairings. And so I've always taught the herbal portion, like the plant diets, one at a time, but this year I'm going to do it in pairs because I think you can learn a lot by comparing and contrasting herbs. So for every module, you'll have two herbs to study and you'll get a little cheat sheet about them before you start the module. And then you'll have an opportunity to work with those two plants and blend them and keep them separate and just really work with them closely. Because my goal is that I want people to be able to find information that they can really use in their own lives, maybe with clients, whether they have a professional herbal practice or maybe they're a therapist in a different field, that they'll know these plants so that they can work with them really comfortably.
I love the different modules that you have, just so we can preview them for people. Module one is vitalism and the heart of herbalism. Module two, building your home apothecary. They're so diverse. I love module three is my favorite, plant spirit medicine, energetics and chemistry. You have such a holistic approach. It's what I've always loved about your teaching. You'll teach about the doctrine of signatures. You'll talk to people about how to communicate with plants, how to think of them as teachers that are living beings, that have personalities, that aren't just, you know, phytochemistry or whatever, but you will also teach phytochemistry. And I think that you have this really well-rounded way of helping people be intelligent about the plants, about the body, about the systems of the body, but also not afraid to use energetic systems, not afraid to take something from the kinds of energetics that ancient mystics were working with, whether that's the elements or whether that's, you know, some of the overlay with things like Ayurveda, Chinese medicine. You take what's useful on a symbolic and energetic plane and on a personal connection level with the plants, and you marry it to really smart scientific research. I think that that's rare. You don't see that a lot.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. To me, it's all language. They're just different languages that we talk about the same thing. And I think the more diverse our languages as herbalists, the more we can reach more people. And that's kind of my goal. Like, I want everyone to like be able to identify plants, use plants. So we need to diversify the languages we speak, so we can talk with our physicians, so we can talk with a therapist, we can talk with a mystic, right? We can talk with children, and we have a language that everyone can use.
You talk in the program, in your modules, you have stuff on digestive and gut health. You have stuff on detoxification, colds and flus, and, you know, dealing with virus seasons. You talk about tissue states, and you're talking about how to give things to your kids for, you know, helping them maybe at times even relax before bed at night. We use a lot of different things with our kids. I love this, that you have called this a community herbalist. What is a community herbalist, so that people can understand that definition? Because sometimes people might look at a course like this and think, gosh, unless I go to an accredited university for, you know, 8 years and learn all about chemistry, I have no right or business suggesting herbs to people or using herbs. That's just not true. And that's not the history of how folk herbal medicine has been used or taught. So what do you mean when you say community herbalist?
I think you said it perfectly. This is the people's medicine, and our grandmothers and great grandparents used plants as medicine. There's nothing actually that like hard about the practice of herbal medicine. It's just getting to know the plants and getting to know the times when they're most useful. I really envision that this course, people can take it and yes, use it for themselves. Number one, because I think a lot changes when we have the personal experience, and then using it in your family, whether that's just, you know, maybe making a tea for your dog, or, you know, if you have kids, or maybe you just have a partner, maybe you have plants you can use, and we'll talk about taking care of a garden, but using it for yourself, for whoever's immediately around you, and then taking it beyond that, because it's likely that at some point you're going to be talking with someone. They're going to say, oh, you know, I've got this digestion thing and I've tried this and this. And they might say, hey, you're studying herbs. Is there anything that you would recommend? And you know what? You'll probably have a few ideas. And that, you know, you never know how one way that you help someone out there in the world might trickle and then help others and more people. So I think through the self-knowledge and studying this knowledge in your own body, it'll naturally, it's like, you know, impossible for it not to spread out and start to affect the broader community.
Yeah, I think that's really important. This is also for that reason, because we have a vision. I mean, you guys know through my Kickstarter, you guys helped us build a community herbal medicine garden that Ashley's been hosting free and donation-based events out of, that the donations go right back into the garden and just growing the medicine that we then find ways of harvesting and giving to other people or letting other people come and harvest. We have a vision, we always have, back to the days when we had our yoga studio in Maryland, we have always had a vision of making this sacred knowledge accessible to people. And that is both there in this program in terms of the way you're framing what it means to be an herbalist. It might mean that you're a professional and you see clients, and you could continue beyond this program developing the skills to do that, this would certainly set you up for success. You could also go forward and be someone who uses what you know with friends and family and yourself. And that's an incredible set of tools to have. The program's also very accessible from both a programming standpoint and a price standpoint. I'm going to take you back over and show everybody. The programs, the modules are pre-recorded, but then you meet outside of the modules for discussion, community, Q&A, and sort of development and integration. So people can attend those live. If they miss those integration sessions, they can also watch the replays of those. So
absolutely, yeah.
Anyone could take this at their own rate, you know, as slowly or as quickly as you wanted to, really soak it in, or blaze through it. And, you know, and then we can certainly, beyond this program, as Ashley perhaps makes more advanced programs available as she's easing back in out of maternity leave, can help you with further development or recommend you to many other wonderful programs where you can continue your studies. We want this to be accessible. We want community herbalism to be, you know, as simple as being able to show a friend a couple of yoga stretches. We should be able to show each other herbs, you know, and just, hey, this is a helpful herb to use. Also, accessibility price-wise, we have an early bird enrollment and we have a standard enrollment. And then we have tuition level one assistance and tuition assistance level two, which break out the affordable tuition into different levels of affordability. And you can kind of identify where you're at if you're someone who wants to take this program but needs to work within your means and not hurt yourself doing it. And then for those who can pay, we ask that you use standard or early bird enrollment. And that's the same thing I do for all my astrology programs. So we try to keep it super, super accessible. The Herbal Apprenticeship Program starts April 24th. I know Ashley's super excited to be getting back into teaching too. I also would like to offer Ashley just a chance to tell everyone a little bit about, before we end here this interview, tell everyone maybe a little bit about your own background, who you studied with, what your influences are, and just anything else you want to say before we cap it off.
Ooh, okay. well, I think, you know, I started off as a kid playing in the woods, mixing perfumes and potions. And then I went on to study environmental science, where I studied organic chemistry and restoring native wetlands. And really from an environmental perspective, that's how I got into herbalism. And then after, you know, I realized after working on the restoration piece and joining a lot of earth advocacy groups that the problem's not with the earth, but with the people not mm-hmm. understanding the value of the earth. So then I started going into holistic medicine. I graduated from University of North Carolina, Asheville with a degree in interdisciplinary studies. And I went on to get my, that was my undergrad. And then I got my master's from the, Maryland University of Integrative Health. It was then called Thai Sophia. But my teachers there, you know, I had such a great blend of teachers, really scientific minds, like Simon Mills from the UK and Kevin Spellman, who is like a chemistry genius. He's also an Ayurvedic practitioner, studied with Dr. Vasant Lad, Matthew Prisco, medicine maker from Galen's Way out in California. So I had a really wonderful, diverse variety of teachers in that 3-year full-time master's level program. And then after that, I went on to study with Matthew Wood pretty intensively because I liked his energetics. I liked the way he spoke about the plants and his personal experience working with low dose, drop dose medicine. And he has had amazing, he's done such amazing work herbally with just using that method. And I've got a lot of herbalists in my basket.
David Duke comes to mind.
Jim Duke, Margie Flint, Rosemary Gladstar is like, I've only done one herb walk with her, but it was amazing. So, you know, I have shelves of herbal books and people who I just adore. And yeah, I just feel really grateful that I've had that blend of the science and the energetic herbalism and the traditional herbalist perspective as well. And I try my best to blend them together and to give everyone a really diverse yet integrated herbal studying experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You get that. That is exactly what you'll get if you sign up for Ashley's program, which I encourage you to do. If this is the kind of thing that interests you, you won't regret it. It's a fantastic course with someone I absolutely love, obviously, but also like a really, truly fantastic human being and teacher of plant medicine. And if you want to learn more about her, see her work, get to know her a little bit, check out her YouTube channel, Skyhouse Herbs, where she publishes weekly on plant medicine, plant energetics, and also on Instagram, which is Skyhouse Herbs. So the apprenticeship program starts April 24th. I wanted to get Ashley on, brag about her program, turn you guys on to it. Thank you so much for being here. And I'm sure that we're going to see some people from the Nightlight astrology world getting introduced to you and all of your magic.
I would love that. Thank you.
All right. Take it easy, everyone.